Hello and welcome, Iris listeners. This is hour three of the Des Moines Register, and I'm your reader, Dale Finnegan. We begin this hour with the obituaries from the Register. From Polk City, Raymond Gerald Mikulin, age 87, passed away peacefully from this earth to be with our Lord on June 26th, surrounded by family. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Tuesday, June 29th, at Assumption Catholic Church, 1906 Sycamore, Granger, Iowa. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, June 30th, at Assumption Catholic Church. Ray was born to Eva and John Mikulin on May 27, 1934, in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. He enjoyed playing hockey throughout his youth, which led him to a professional career as a goalie in the IHL and AHL. Later on, he managed the Des Moines Ice Arena and owned and operated Ray's Restaurant and the Carousel Lounge in Des Moines. Ray met Sharon Leopold at the Carousel, and in 1976, they became owners-operators of Mary's Cafe in Polk City, Iowa, and renamed it the Landmark Restaurant. Ray was affectionately known by their many friends and patrons as Nice Guy Ray. They enjoyed 33 happy years at the Landmark, retiring in 2009. Ray is survived by his loving wife of 44 years, Sharon, son, Dale Mikulin, spouse Patty of Houston, Texas, his four stepchildren, Kathy Rucker, spouse Jeff, Brian Leopold, spouse Melissa, Shelley Burns, spouse Jim, and Johnny Leopold, spouse Ann, 17 grandchildren, and 13 great-grandchildren. He was preceded in death by his parents, brother Lou Mikulin, and his sister-in-law, Betty. Online at www.memorialservicesofiowa.com. Gary L. Parker of Waukee, age 81, passed away June 25th. A memorial service will be held at 10 a.m. on Thursday, July 1st at Hamilton's on Westtown Parkway, 3601 Westtown Parkway in West Des Moines. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, June 30th, also at the funeral home. Burial will follow the service at Waukee Cemetery. Gary was born June 16, 1940, in Walnut, to Ira and Lolita Briggs Parker. He married Karen Eckhart on April 15, 1961. Gary will be remembered for his keen sense of humor and unwavering love for his family. He loved a good get-together filled with kids and activity. His favorite saying was, "All you need in life is two good things, laughter and good music." He is survived by his children, Deborah Parker, Donna Rydell, spouse Larry, Deanna Spry, spouse Scott, Dan Parker, spouse Lisa, and Dave Parker, spouse Kelsey. 12 grandchildren, Alan Lockie, spouse Stacy, Susie Nelson, spouse Matt, Ellie Rydell, Laura Heifner, spouse Tom, Sarah Denny, spouse John, Megan Tilly, spouse Robert, Chris Lake Lockie, spouse Nat, Morgan Brock, Abigail Bryce, and Ira Parker, and great-grandchildren, Henley, Mallory, Taylor, Tristan, Alexis, Kaylin, Evie, Zach, Braxton, and Scarlett. Brothers, Gail and Lynn Parker. Gary was preceded in death by his wife, Karen, grandson, Joey Lockie, and 8 siblings. Memorial contributions may be directed to the family. Condolences may be expressed online at www.hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Myron Wilson Hosted, known as Miney, age 89, of Urbandale, lost his short battle with cancer on June 25th at his home, surrounded by his loving family. He was born on January 28, 1932, on the family farm outside Ogden. Myron was the younger of two sons born to Meinhardt and Elsie Wilson Hosted. He married Janet Muller on December 21, 1958. They enjoyed 62 wonderful years together while raising three sons. Early in life, Miney excelled in all sports, but especially basketball. He He served in the Army during the Korean War and afterwards owned and operated a variety of businesses, including a finance company, a nightclub, a beverage dispensing business, and an air purifying business. He joked on his 70th birthday that he still hadn't decided what he wanted to do for a career. His hobbies included fishing, golfing, investing, gardening, snowmobiling, polka dancing, and spending time with Janet and his family. He is survived by his wife Janet, three sons, Mark, Joel, spouse Denise, and Todd, spouse Shirley, five grandchildren, and two great-grandchildren. Visitation will be at Caldwell Parish Funeral Home in Urbandale on Wednesday, June 30th from 5 to 7 p.m. A celebration of life will be held at Gloria Day Lutheran Church in Urbandale on Thursday, July 1st at 10:30 a.m. He will be interred at Glenwood Cemetery in Ogden. Memorials may be sent to Iowa Chapter of the American Parkinson Disease Association or Gloria Day Lutheran Church in Urbandale. A special thank you to Unity Point Hospice and Maggie. Online condolences may be expressed at www.caldwellparish.com. From Pleasant Hill, Richard J. Sheehy, known as Dick, age 89, passed away peacefully at Taylor House Hospice on June 26th. A visitation for friends and family will be held from 2 to 4 p.m., Thursday, July 1st, at Isles Dunn's Chapel. Cremation rites will follow. Dick was born November 14, 1931, in Des Moines, to parents Michael and Agnes Sheehy. Left to cherish his memory are his daughters, Terry Richardson, spouse Rich, Debbie Johnson, and Kathy Rickert, spouse Johnny. Grandchildren, Lisa Pruitt, spouse Chris, Jason Umphress, spouse Deb, Todd Benson, spouse Vanessa, Jack Miller, spouse Heather, and Jessica Jones, spouse Brandon. 11 great-grandchildren and 3 great-great-grandchildren. He was preceded in death by his parents, his wife Donna, son Michael, infant son Richard, and a brother, Frank. Memorial contributions may be directed to Taylor House Hospice or Animal Rescue League of Iowa. Online condolences are welcome at www.islescares.com. James Dwight Thomas, known as Beau, of Urbandale, age 87, died on June 26th at Unity Point Methodist Medical Center. He was born and raised in Des Moines, where he married Opal Motes in 1961 and enjoyed 52 years of marriage. He was a garage mechanic for Iowa Power and Light Company and a welder for Mid-American Energy for 42 years. He owned Westtown Auto and Central Body Shop for decades, combining his love for cars with a second career. He loved boating with his family and friends, any and all sports, NASCAR, and a good scotch. You can put this in my obituary, that I loved all of my grandchildren and great-grandchildren and loved every minute of them. He was preceded in death by his parents, his sister, Toadie Kinney, and his loving wife, Opal. He is survived by his children, Debbie Wood, T. O'Reilly, Rhonda Amon, spouse Mike, Vicki Morris, spouse Steve, and Todd Thomas. His grandchildren, Debrina, spouse Dustin, O'Brienna, James, spouse Danielle, Hallie, Michael, Jamie, spouse Joe, Allie, spouse Justin, Ryan, spouse Christy, and Chaz, spouse Brittany, and 8 great-grandchildren. The family would also like to acknowledge and thank his lifetime friend, Bob Niffenegger, or Niff, who was his best friend and, in quotes, brother, for over 70 years. Services will be held at Isles Westover Funeral Home on Wednesday, June 30th. Visitation will be from 11 to 1, with funeral to follow. Online condolences may be expressed at www.islescares.com. Memorial contributions may be made to Every Step. That concludes today's obituaries from the Register. I'll turn now to the sports section, and here are the headlines from the front page there. NCAA Council makes more moves, recommends schools in states without NIL laws should set policies. This is an article from the USA Today by Stephen Berkowitz. Ex-Indian Hill sprinter Bednarik qualifies for Olympics. This column is written by Matthew Bain. Hermosillo beating odds with Iowa Cubs. Tommy Birch has that story. And at the bottom of the page, Hawkeyes looking to limit mistakes, score more. This piece is written by Kennington Lloyd Smith III. And at the top of the page, here's the story from Steve Berkowitz. NCAA Council makes more moves. The NCAA Division I Council on Monday recommended that the association temporarily, quote, suspend amateurism rules, end quote, related to athletes' ability to make money from their name, image, and likeness, the association announced. The council is the division's day-to-day policy-making group, primarily comprising athletic administrators. Its recommendation now goes to the Division I Board of Directors, a panel comprising mainly college presidents, that is the division's top rules-making committee. The board is scheduled to meet Wednesday, and it seems likely it will approve the recommendation. Monday's action came with 10 states having passed laws or seen governors issue executive orders that will allow athletes to make money from their name, image, and likeness, or NIL, beginning Thursday or whenever their schools choose. This includes Ohio, whose Governor Mike DeWine signed an executive order on Monday. Bills with Thursday effective dates are on the desks of governors in four other states. Altogether, more than 15 states could have NIL laws in effect by September 1st. Under the plan suggested Monday, schools in states that have passed laws related to NIL would be, quote, responsible for determining whether athletes' NIL activities are consistent with state law, an NCAA statement said. In states without an NIL law, athletes would be able to engage in NIL activities without violating NCAA rules that so far have heavily limited those activities, which include having endorsement deals, leveraging social media for pay, and making money from coaching or signing autographs. Schools in states without NIL laws and/or their conferences, quote, may choose to adopt their own policies regarding NIL activities, the NCAA statement said. However, the policy would leave intact the association's commitment to avoid pay-for-play and improper inducements tied to choosing to attend a particular school, the statement said. This setup would remain in place until federal legislation or new NCAA rules are adopted, the statement said. In choosing this path, the council rejected another proposal that, while largely similar, also included the proviso that schools' NIL policies not allow payments from any booster or any person or entity acting on behalf of the school. This indicates that the council was concerned that virtually any restriction on a temporary policy would draw a legal challenge based on the Supreme Court's ruling last week in the Alston antitrust case. The court unanimously decided that the NCAA's rules on athlete compensation are subject to detailed antitrust analysis, and such an analysis showed that the association's limits on education-related benefits for athletes violate the law. We don't have a lot of options on this. The Alston decision came down, Metro Atlantic Athletic Conference Commissioner Rick Enzer said Monday afternoon. While not a member of the council, Enzer is an attorney. He also is well connected with the thinking of commissioners of other mid-major conferences, and he said nearly all segments of Division I are pretty well unified on this. He added, "This should be an interesting period we are entering into. It's going to be tough for institutional compliance people to manage what we passed." Presuming the board of directors goes along with the council, athletes in states without NIL laws could end up with greater freedom for their NIL activities than those in some states with NIL laws. In Alabama, for instance, the law establishes the Alabama Collegiate Athletics Commission. The commission's purpose is to develop rules and recommendations to maintain the fairness and integrity of amateur intercollegiate athletics. And here's Matthew Bain's column. Ex-Indian Hill sprinter Bednarik qualifies for Olympics. In fall 2018, shortly after Kenny Bednarik arrived at Indian Hills Community College in Ottumwa, Iowa, head track coach Brent Ewing talked with his star freshman sprinter outside the weight room. Ewing asked Bednarik, "What are your goals?" He was very adamant, Ewing remembered in a conversation with the Register on Monday. He wanted to go to the Olympics. Now, nearly 3 years later, he is. Bednarik earned a spot on Team USA Sunday night at the U.S. Olympic Team Trials in Eugene, Oregon, finishing second in the men's 200-meter dash in 19.78 seconds, which is a personal best time. Noah Lyles, who won in 19.74 seconds, and 17-year-old Arian Knighton, who took third in 19.84 seconds, also qualified. He's happy he made the Olympics, but he wants to win. He wanted to win last night, Ewing said. There's a big part of Kenny that wants to get back on top and beat Lyles and get a gold medal at Tokyo. Bednarik, the first Iowa junior college athlete to ever qualify for the U.S. Olympics team, according to Iowa track expert Mike Jay, took an unusual path to the Olympics. He was the number two overall sprinter in the 2018 recruiting class coming out of Rice Lake High School in northwest Wisconsin, about 2 hours from Minneapolis. Basically, every track power program in the country recruited him, and he committed to Oregon. But his high school grades weren't where they needed to be, and he had to take the junior college route. He chose Indian Hills. At Indian Hills, Bednarik quickly proved why he was so highly sought after in high school. In December of 2018, at the Mel Cherdsma Classic in Missouri, Bednarik ran the 400-meter dash in 45.93. At the time, it was a world-leading indoor mark. "That's when I was like, okay, this kid is really, really special," Ewing said. In March, at the Junior College Outdoor Nationals, he ran 20.43 in the 200 and 45.97 in the 400. Then, in April, at the 2019 Drake Relays, Bednarik won the men's elite 200 in 20.29, which was more than 0.3 seconds faster than the field. 1 month later, in May, Bednarik won the 200 and 400 at the Junior College Outdoor Nationals at 19.82 and 44.73. He became the second man ever, and the first American, to run the 200 and 400 in less than 20 seconds and 45 seconds on the same day. It was then that he decided to turn pro, and he signed with Nike in July of 2019. Injuries and COVID-19's effect on the 2020 season have prevented Bednarik's professional career from taking off. But his qualification for the Tokyo Olympics goes a long way to proving he is an elite sprinter. "Definitely vindication. I was happy for him," Ewing said, "because I do think there are some people out there who, maybe prior to these trials, maybe didn't take him real seriously. Or thought, okay, this kid has posted fast times, but can he really do it when it matters?" Bednarik answered that question Sunday night. Hermosillo beating odds with Iowa Cubs, Tommy Birch's story today. When Michael Hermosillo decided he was going to pass on playing football at Illinois, he wanted to tell the head coach then, Tim Beckman, in person. Hermosillo was being lured away from the football scholarship by the Los Angeles Angels, who selected him in the 28th round of the 2013 draft. But when the two met, Beckman told the outfielder it wasn't a good idea. He was just like, "You're a 28th round pick. What are even the odds that you make it to the big leagues being that?" Hermosillo recalled of his talk with Beckman. "And I was like, you're probably right in terms of my odds, but I do believe in my ability." That conversation is part of what has motivated Hermosillo on the baseball field. Years later, he's still proving people like Beckman, who was later fired in 2015 amid a player abuse allegation at Illinois, wrong. Meanwhile, the 26-year-old, who signed a minor league deal with the Chicago Cubs during the offseason, has become one of the best hitters so far this season while playing in AAA for the Iowa Cubs. There's definitely those little things you take with you where it just has that little extra chip on your shoulder when maybe you don't want to get up for a Saturday workout or something like that, Hermosillo said. You definitely remember that for sure. It's a story that's difficult to forget. Hermosillo, who was listed as a 5'10", 190-pound slot back out of high school, committed to Illinois back in 2012. He was ranked a three-star recruit by 247 Sports and planned to play baseball and football at Illinois. But that never happened after the Angels selected Hermosillo in the 2012 draft, the night before he was set to report for football that summer. Hermosillo, who had suffered three stingers in high school, thought he had a better shot of staying healthy playing baseball. The Angels also lured him away from Illinois by reportedly giving him a $100,000 signing bonus. But because Illinois and Beckman had invested so much time recruiting him as a football player, Hermosillo wanted to break the news to the coach in person that he wouldn't be playing. A phone call, he decided, wasn't appropriate. The Illinois coach tried talking him out of it, Hermosillo recalled. He was definitely like, I don't know if this is going to be the right choice for you, Hermosillo said. For Hermosillo, things worked out just fine. Hermosillo played parts of six seasons in the minor leagues before making his big league debut in 2018. Hermosillo beat the long shot odds of a late round draft pick, appearing in 56 games for the Angels from 2018 to 2020. But Hermosillo's hope of staying healthy hasn't happened. Hermosillo missed the start of the regular season after he fractured two bones in his right hand during spring training. It happened when another car pulled out in front of the one Hermosillo was driving. The airbags deployed and injured his hand. Hermosillo's injury didn't require surgery, but it did slow the start of his season. He made the most of that time anyway, though working on drills with his right arm. Hermosillo believes the extra work may have paid off this season. No one is arguing with Hermosillo's decision these days, especially with how he's producing. Hermosillo, who is in his first season in the Cubs organization, has solidified himself as one of the top hitters in the organization. During his first 17 games with Iowa, Hermosillo slashed .362, .479, .603, and tallied an OPS of 1.082. Hermosillo has also showcased strong defense, like in Thursday night's game against Omaha when he made a diving catch in center to rob Ryan McBroom of a hit. While I'm super grateful for the start I've had and the numbers that I've put up, I feel like I'm more happy with how I've stayed consistent with what I'm trying to do, approach-wise with my work ethic and stuff like that, Hermosillo said. A new focus and more time spent on his pregame approach is part of what Hermosillo believes has led to his success this season. The key is to keep it going and prove to the Cubs, which have had trouble getting consistent production from spots in its outfield, that Hermosillo can help solve some of those problems. It may seem like a long shot for a 26-year-old in a minor league contract, but Hermosillo has already shown he can beat the odds. It was a good decision, Hermosillo said. And from the bottom of the page, Kennington Lloyd Smith III's story, Hawkeyes looking to limit mistakes, score more. With a return to normalcy in 2021, the Hawkeyes football team is looking forward to putting the not-so-fond memories of a COVID-19-riddled year behind them. However, there were valuable lessons learned from last season. One big lesson? The importance of starting a season strong and keeping mental errors from halting that momentum. In their first two games of the 2020 season, Iowa was a neutral zero in turnover differential with five giveaways and five takeaways. Additionally, they committed 13 penalties, including 10 in the season opening loss to Purdue. As a result, they sputtered out to an 0-2 start and had to climb out of that hole for the remainder of the season. Head coach Kirk Ferentz said it himself, "Iowa cannot succeed with mental errors." This offseason, the focus has been on making sure that they're more fundamentally sound to start the upcoming season. Needless to say, that really hurt us in Game 2 against Northwestern, Ferentz said. Penalties, turnovers in Game 1 against Purdue as well. "If we're going to play good football, we need to be really good in that area. That's our DNA. We have to do that. I think that takes practice. I think that takes cohesion, and it probably helps if you don't have an inexperienced quarterback. No guarantees, but at least your odds are a little better." Back to the not-so-fond COVID-related memories of 2020. The Hawkeyes, every college team really, fell victim to lost preparation time ahead of the season, including not having a spring practice period. The Big Ten in particular faced delays to start their season. The conference was originally supposed to kick off on September 3rd, but postponed their season only 6 days after releasing the schedule. After a month of pushback, the season was set to resume in late October. Factor in daily unpredictability of playing a sport through a pandemic, like players missing time to positive tests or contact tracing, and it was difficult for the team to find a rhythm. "That's just how the season went a little bit last year," veteran receiver Nico Reganey said. "We didn't have spring ball because of COVID. It was tough. During some practices, some people were getting quarantined and couldn't practice and stuff. It was a little bit of a rocky start." Players point to their Week 3 win over Michigan State as the turning point in their season. The Hawkeyes were +3 in turnover margin, including zero giveaways in their dominant 49-7 win. In the following 5 games, all wins, they won the turnover battle every time. For the season, they finished +8 in turnover differential. "Those first 2 games hurt a lot," defensive back Riley Moss said. "We prepared our season, got canceled, and put on again, so it was kind of a whole mess. But we never made excuses because everyone had to go through the same stuff. We just put our heads down and went to work." Moss's unit, the defensive backfield, was especially key in the team's turnaround. The secondary accounted for 8 interceptions during the 6-game win streak. Overall, the defense scored 13 turnovers during that time. "We have a goal sheet each week," Moss said. "That's one of our goals. Win in turnovers and takeaways. I think that puts us in a positive spot when we have turnovers and give the offense a chance to score." Offensively, the unit became more cohesive. Quarterback Spencer Petras cut down on interceptions from 3 in the first 2 games to only 2 in the final 6 games. Additionally, running back Tyler Goodson eclipsed 100 yards in 5 of the final 6 games after sub-100-yard games in their opening losses. This year, the offense hopes to take the next step, controlling the ball and scoring more points. "We know last year there were times we didn't put enough points on the board," Reganey said. "This year, our goal is to put more points on the board, obviously." And what's a good way to score more points? That goes back to what Coach Ferentz said, taking care of the ball. "Coach Ferentz is talking about that all of the time," Reganey said. "If you don't turn the ball over during a game, chances are you're the team coming out with a victory. If we can limit mistakes and not turn the ball over, we're confident in getting the win." That will do it for the sports section. I'll turn now to the Iowa Life pages of the Register. The featured article here is titled, "R Plus C's. Owners of Simons and Harbingers collaborate on Windsor Heights Diner." And this story is written by Ellie Wignall. The story of R Plus C's Diner is one of being in the right place at the right time. Simon Goheen, owner of the wildly popular Simons on Franklin Avenue, and his wife Sarah were walking in Windsor Heights last year when they stopped at R.I. restaurant for a drink. While there, they learned R.I. would be closing the next day. The Goheens were interested in the space for a breakfast-only diner. When it went on the market, they placed a bid on the 6587 University Avenue building, once home to fine dining establishment Baru 66, and before that, French restaurant Sage. Meanwhile, Joe Tripp, owner of James Beard-nominated Harbinger on Ingersoll Avenue, was looking for a space to house his Korean fried chicken pop-up, Basic Bird, that gained popularity during the COVID-19 pandemic, while his Small Plates restaurant was on hiatus. He, too, noticed the building on University Avenue and thought it could be a good home for Harbinger, freeing up its current space for Basic Bird. So he placed a bid. A bidding war ensued, but the participants remained unknown to one another. Tripp lost, and the Goheens swiped up the space in November of 2020 and began transforming it into their breakfast nook, Rory's, named for their one-and-a-half-year-old daughter. They installed dark green booths with high backs and curated art from Moberg Gallery. Fast forward to March of 2021. Simon Goheen stopped by Harbinger to pick up a Basic Bird order one night, and Tripp revealed that he had been the competing bidder. The two got to talking, and Goheen offered to let Tripp use the space in the evenings for Basic Bird. A deal was struck. But the restaurateurs, who had known each other for some time, quickly concluded that one restaurant would work better than two. They had never planned to work together, but they found they were able to easily bounce ideas off each other, and those ideas snowballed. Rory's became R plus C's, the C for Clayton, the youngest of Tripp's three children, only a few months younger than Rory. "I don't think there are too many people I could jump into a partnership with right away blindly, and it's just worked," Tripp said. With their families close in age, he and Goheen have become fast friends as well as colleagues. Set to open mid-July, R plus C's Diner hopes to bring together the best of nostalgic breakfast food, family heritage, and memorable desserts to become the go-to gathering spot in the Windsor Heights neighborhood. The restaurant is focusing on being a family hangout, with not only delicious food and drinks for adults, but a good kids menu and eye-popping desserts. The emphasis on family is prominent, not only in the diner's namesakes, a large picture of both families' children taken by local photographer Byron Jones will adorn the entryway wall. And you'll find their names on some special dishes. For customers, Tripp wants to be the place in the neighborhood where the kids say they want to come, and mom and dad are like, "Cool, that sounds good to us." Chefs from Harbinger and Simon's are sharing the kitchen, with Simon's Homero Adame running the show at breakfast and Harbinger's Mackenzie Schultz taking over for dinner. The two programs will work collaboratively to minimize food waste and combine influences. For Goheen, that means classic diner breakfast staples with some healthy and trendy options like acai bowls and avocado toast. And for Tripp, it's an opportunity to move away from the Asian-inspired dishes at Harbinger's for an exploration of his Jewish heritage. Since we came in, blending the two, it's kind of written itself. Like, what if we put latkes on an eggs benedict, or change the egg salad so it's a bialy? How can we use corned beef? How can we use smoked salmon? Tripp said. We're not going for kosher Jewish deli here, but little bits of it scattered throughout. Everyone's had eggs benedict, but maybe not on latkes with house-cured salmon. Dessert is in the hands of his wife, Alexandra, who has spent the past year developing recipes inspired by a family vacation. We had a fun trip where we went to a diner in the middle of nowhere in Colorado, and our son, Zephyr, got this big shake, and it was probably his favorite moment of the whole trip, she said. With that childlike excitement in mind, she said she is creating indulgent but familiar treats like giant stuffed cookies and specialty shakes. The diner's bar offers additional seating and is stocked with 5 local beers and Prosecco on tap. Rotating cocktails will be available from breakfast through dinner, some with interesting breakfast twists like the Everything But the Bagel cocktail. The R plus C's team is building a specialty coffee drink menu with the help of Andrea Cummings, owner of Dreiberge Coffee in the East Village. You want to kind of bring in something that people don't have access to. So it's nice to have that change of pace over here, where if people do like Dreiberge and they don't want to go to the East Village all the time, maybe this is a nice spot to get introduced to their coffee, Goheen said. It's been fun, and Cummings has been super helpful. With their sights set on creating a Windsor Heights institution, both families are working to put the finishing touches on the space before opening day. It's a daily occurrence to have an excited community member peek in the front door and ask about progress, Tripp said. Windsor Heights is a great neighborhood, and I feel like breakfast is just a good fit in this area, Goheen said. We want to be that neighborhood breakfast spot, the staple. It's all about food today, apparently. At the bottom of the page, the Life section has a From the Dietitian article written by Ashley Danielson. The title is Add Red, White, and Blue Foods to Your Holiday Table. Is there anything more American than the 4th of July? As we get ready to celebrate the holiday with meals featuring summer classics like hot dogs, hamburgers, and apple pie, why not mix it up and celebrate with some fun, patriotic plates? Make your food festive and nutritious by adding red, white, and blue foods to your entrees, side dishes, appetizers, and desserts. 3 reasons why you should add red, white, and blue foods to your 4th of July celebration. Red foods. Red fruits and vegetables are packed with antioxidants, which help fight free radicals and lower the risk for diseases like heart disease, cancer, and stroke. Red bell peppers, strawberries, and tart cherries are high in vitamin C, which is great for our immune system. Red bell peppers have more vitamin C than an orange. Tomatoes are a great source of lycopene, which helps protect against some cancers. White foods. Cauliflower is an excellent non-starchy vegetable that is packed with vitamin C and folate, which helps support a healthy immune system and provide energy. Cauliflower has a mild flavor that can be seasoned in various ways. It can be used as a substitution for rice and pizza crusts for those looking to add more veggies into their diets. White potatoes are packed with potassium, especially if you eat the skin, which is good for our hearts. Blue foods. Blueberries are loaded with antioxidants that help protect against aging, cancer, and heart disease. The antioxidants in blueberries may also help aid your brain and prevent mental decline with aging. Blackberries are high in vitamin C, vitamin K, and fiber. Vitamin C helps keep our immune systems strong. Vitamin K helps our blood clot better, and fiber is great for our gut function. Purple potatoes are higher in antioxidants than regular potatoes, which makes them a great, colorful option when you want to enjoy potatoes with your meal. Next, this article includes a recipe for tart cherry sorbet. It serves 6 people, and you will need 4 cups of frozen unsweetened tart cherries, divided, 2 frozen bananas, peeled and sliced, divided, 2 cups of vanilla Greek yogurt, divided, 1/2 cup of pomegranate juice, divided. And here's how you make it. Place 1/2 of the frozen cherries, banana, Greek yogurt, and pomegranate juice in a blender. Cover and blend until smooth, scraping down the sides as needed. Pour the mixture into an 8x4-inch loaf pan. Repeat the process of blending the remaining 1/2 of the ingredients. Add to the mixture in the loaf pan. Cover and freeze at least 4 hours or until firm. Let that stand for 30 minutes before serving. Here are the nutrition facts per serving. 140 calories, 0 grams of fat, 0 grams of saturated fat, 0 grams of trans fat, 0 milligrams of cholesterol, 40 milligrams sodium, 26 carbohydrates, 2 grams fiber, 1 gram sugar, 9 grams of protein. You'll get 0% of your daily vitamin D, 8% of your calcium, 6% of your iron, and 6% of your daily potassium need. That will do it for the Register today. I'll turn to the USA Today and begin with the short moneyline stories. Honda electric SUV plan for 2024. Honda announced Monday that it will introduce an electric SUV called the Prologue, marking the automaker's first attempt to sell an EV in high volume as it pivots away from gasoline-powered cars. The launch is part of Honda's plan to switch to all zero-emission vehicles in North America by 2040, including battery electric cars and hydrogen vehicles. Dave Gardner, Executive Vice President of American Honda, said the 2024 Prologue is being developed in partnership with General Motors, whose battery system will be used on the vehicle. Shake Shack joins Chicken Sandwich Wars. Shake Shack will roll out a summer menu July 1st, which will include a new hot honey chicken sandwich. The sandwich is a crispy chicken breast with honey glaze, along with habanero mayo sauce and shredded lettuce on a toasted potato bun. The menu will be available until October 4th. Homeowner racial gap highest in Twin Cities. The Twin Cities metro area has the nation's highest racial gap when it comes to home ownership, largely because investors have been buying hundreds of single-family homes and turning them into rentals, according to the Urban Institute. Research found roughly one-fifth of Black households own their homes, compared with nearly three-quarters of white households. The Latino home ownership rate of about 35% remained constant. The Star Tribune reported that the Black home ownership rate in Hennepin and Ramsey counties fell 10 percentage points between 2000 and 2018, while rates for whites stayed relatively constant, according to analysis of property records and census data. Here's an interesting story from the USA Today. Scientists find early human, challenging history of evolution. This is written by Gabriella Miranda. Scientists say they have discovered a new kind of early human in Israel after studying pieces of fossilized bone dug up at a site used by a cement plant in central Israel. After studying fossils in Israel, scientists said Thursday that they discovered a new kind of early human. Researchers from Tel Aviv University and the Hebrew University of Jerusalem told Reuters they found pieces of a skull and lower jaw with teeth dating back 130,000 years, calling into question what we thought we knew about the human family tree. The fossil has been named Nesher Ramla Homo, after the site southeast of Tel Aviv where it was found. The new species coexisted with Homo sapiens for more than 100,000 years. Some scientists said the two species may have been interbred. The discovery of a new type of Homo is of great scientific importance, said Israel Hershkovitz of Tel Aviv University, one of the leaders of the team that analyzed the remains. It enables us to make new sense of previously found human fossils, add another piece to the puzzle of human evolution, and understand the migrations of humans in the old world. The discovery also unveiled characteristics of the new species, including very large teeth and no chin. The fossils were found among stone tools and the bones of horses and deer, similar to pre-Neanderthal groups in Europe. The skull was flat, and a 3D shape analysis eliminated a connection to any other known group. These findings all challenge the original thinking that our evolutionary cousins originated in Europe. This is what makes us suggest that this Nesher Ramla group is actually a large group that started very early in time and are the source of the European Neanderthal, said Hyla May, a physical anthropologist at the Dan David Center and the Shmunis Institute of Tel Aviv University. Experts have never been able to fully explain how Homo sapiens genes were present in the earlier Neanderthal population in Europe, May said. And she believes the Nesher Ramla may be able to solve that mystery. I'll turn to the Nation and Health section and read some of the coronavirus news briefing now. As TSA reports travel uptick, concerns swirl. As the 4th of July approaches Sunday, health officials are concerned about an increased spread of the Delta variant of COVID-19 in pockets of the nation where vaccination rates remain low. President Joe Biden had hoped to get 70% of adult Americans at least partially vaccinated by the holiday, but the White House last week said that the goal will fall short. Now, with Transportation Security Administration screening numbers trending upward, including the highest recorded number since March 7th of 2020, reported on Friday, holiday revelry is expected to be at full force. Dr. Janie Morgan, executive director of Piedmont Healthcare's Coronavirus Task Force in Atlanta, told CNN that since children under 12 are still not eligible for the vaccine, it makes it even more important for those who are eligible to get vaccinated and reduce the transmission of the Delta variant. Those mutations have the ability to continue to learn, to become smarter, and eventually evade the immunization status of the rest of us, Morgan said. The Delta variant makes up more than 20% of cases in the U.S. as of June 19th. In California, the variant accounts for 14.5% of cases, according to state statistics. Mixing Pfizer-AstraZeneca vaccines is, quote, highly effective. Mixing one dose of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine and one dose of the AstraZeneca Oxford shot provides protection against the coronavirus, a British vaccine study found. Researchers measured the immune response in more than 800 volunteers who were given two doses of the vaccine 4 weeks apart. They found the highest antibody response was seen after two doses of Pfizer, and that the level of antibodies differed depending on the order the doses were received, according to a paper published in the Lancet preprint server. Those who received the AstraZeneca vaccine followed by the Pfizer shot had a better immune response than those who received the Pfizer dose first. Both mixed schedules induced more antibodies than two AstraZeneca shots alone and are likely to be highly effective and could be considered, in some circumstances, for national vaccine programs, researchers wrote. Researchers are expected to release soon the results of a similar study with a 12-week gap between doses. Lead researcher Matthew Snape from the University of Oxford told the BBC that the longer interval between doses leads to a better immune response. Given the United Kingdom's stable supply of vaccines, there is no reason to change the current vaccine schedule, Deputy Chief Medical Officer Professor Jonathan Van Tam said in a statement. But we now know mixing doses could provide us with even greater flexibility for a booster program, while also supporting countries who have further to go with their vaccine rollouts and who may be experiencing supply difficulties. Make-A-Wish to resume granting certain wishes. The Make-A-Wish Foundation plans to expand wishes to include air travel within the U.S., and its territories, and large gatherings to children and families who have been vaccinated on September 15th, according to a statement published Sunday. The nonprofit's president and CEO, Richard Davis, said in a video circulating on social media that families will be asked to sign a letter of understanding that certifies adults and children participating in the wish have been vaccinated. The foundation said it will not require anyone to get vaccinated to get a wish, but did not specify policies regarding air travel and large gatherings wishes for unvaccinated children. The announcement prompted backlash on Twitter, as the COVID-19 vaccine is not yet authorized for children under 12 years old, and some parents choose not to have their children vaccinated. Make-A-Wish has not responded to USA Today's request for comment. Make-A-Wish granted over 6,500 wishes to vaccinated and unvaccinated children since the start of the pandemic that have included road trips, virtual celebrity meetings, staycations, and more, according to the foundation's statement. Also in the news, the U.S. began shipping its first doses of Pfizer's vaccine abroad Monday, CNN reported, sending 2 million doses to Peru. The shipment comes weeks after the White House announced purchasing 500 million doses to donate to 92 low-income countries. Malaysia's leader says the country will indefinitely extend a near-total lockdown that's been in place for a month as infections remain high. To finish up, I'll read portions of a fact-check article that's included on this page, the title of which is WHO Updated Advice on Vaccinating Children. The introduction says some social media users share guidance purportedly from the World Health Organization that children should not be vaccinated against the coronavirus. The WHO, who founded in 1948 as an agency of the United Nations, advises countries on how to respond to global health emergencies. The agency has become a target of misinformation amid the coronavirus pandemic. An Instagram post on June 23rd reads, "The WHO says children should not receive COVID-19 vaccines." On June 22nd, a Facebook user shared a similar claim, linking to a WHO page that purportedly said children should not be vaccinated for the moment. USA Today was unable to reach the Instagram or Facebook users for comment. Among those who shared the claim was Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, who tweeted, "The WHO says, quote, children should not be vaccinated," end quote. There is more to the WHO's vaccination guidance than the social media post suggests. The guidance was less about safety than about availability of vaccines around the world. The organization's site has been updated to reflect new information about the Pfizer vaccine for children aged 12 and older. Amy Edwards, a pediatric infectious disease specialist at Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital, emphasized that the WHO gives recommendations broadly relevant to the entire world, while the CDC's guidance relates specifically to the United States, where vaccine supply is not limited. And they both ultimately say the same thing. Kids are safe to be vaccinated with Pfizer between the ages of 12 and 18, but they place their emphasis slightly differently because of the population they are addressing, Edwards told USA Today via email. Jasarevich said vaccine trials for children are ongoing and the WHO will update its recommendations when the evidence or epidemiological situation warrants a change of policy. The rating for this claim, according to this fact check, is it is missing content. The information shared on the social media posts is outdated, and the WHO has updated its site to add that the Pfizer vaccine is safe for people ages 12 and older. Advice from the WHO applies to countries where vaccine supply is limited. The CDC recommends everyone 12 and older get vaccinated against the coronavirus. And with that, we'll turn back to the Register to read Dear Abby's column. The headline today, "Readers' Attempts to Move On from Past Boyfriend Still Failing." Dear Abby, for a long time, I have been in love with a man who is 15 years younger than I am. We had a relationship for about a year, which ended 6 years ago. Since then, we have remained friends and occasionally hooked up a few times. The short relationship we had was close to perfect. He broke it off with me because he said he couldn't give me the relationship I really wanted, and I would end up resenting him or even hating him for it. Although I didn't understand that when he said it, I understand now he was right. The problem is, I cannot seem to get over him. I've had two unsuccessful relationships since. They weren't the same as it was with him. I don't know what to do. A few months ago, I cut off everything with him, and we haven't talked in many months. It's not working. I'm still in love with him and can't get him out of my head. I mentioned the age difference because I had a hard time with it, but he didn't. What else can I do? I'm afraid to start anything with someone new. Signed, Hopeless in New York. Dear Hopeless, what you are describing is painful, but it's happening because you haven't accepted the reason the two of you broke up. He said he couldn't give you the relationship you really wanted, whatever that was. You are not in love with this man. You are in love with the fantasy of the person you wanted him to be. Once that fact is firmly in place in your head, you will be able to move forward, although it may take help from a licensed psychotherapist to help accomplish that. Whatever it takes, please do it so you can start living your life. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Des Moines Register for Tuesday, June 29th, 2021. You can hear this show again at 6 p.m. and then again at 1 a.m. Recordings are available on our website, which is iowaradioreading.org. All material heard on IRIS is intended for the use of Iowans who are print disabled. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call at 515-243-6833. You can also call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa. That number is 1-877-404-4747. Once again, we want you to know that our program schedule has changed so that we can get as much local information to as many listeners as possible. The Fort Dodge Messenger will be read at 7 a.m. Monday through Friday. The Mason City Globe Gazette will be read at 8 a.m. Monday through Friday. Your Des Moines Register will continue to be read from 9 a.m. to noon each day. The Cedar Rapids Gazette will be read at noon 7 days a week. The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier will be read at 1 p.m. 7 days a week. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald will be read at 2 p.m. Monday through Friday. The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil will be read at 3 p.m. Monday through Friday. The Sioux City Journal will be read at 4 p.m. 7 days a week. The Ames Tribune will be read at 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. The Midweek Shopping Cart is read each Wednesday at 9 p.m. We will stay with this schedule until further notice. I'm your reader, Dale Finnegan. It's been a pleasure to read for you today. Stay tuned for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. And thank you for listening to Your Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.